You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Serafina Nova Glass on the show with me today. She has a phenomenal new book. It's called Someone's Listening. And when you're hearing this, it's been out for a couple of days now. And this is a must grab for your summer reading shelf that you're going to go to. I love this book, and I know you will too. Welcome to the show, Serafina.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. Serafina, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, that is hard to pinpoint, I think. I guess growing up, I didn't have any, I couldn't even conceive of that being a reality. That seemed like, something really smart, scholarly people did. So I don't even think it was a thought in my head that that would be some kind of career I could have. I guess in college, a couple of other students wrote this play, a musical actually, and they put it up on stage at the university. And I was like, I mean, our peers were all actors in it. There was an audience. It was this actual show with a beginning, middle, and end. And I thought, wow, that's something I really want to do. I can't believe, you know, somebody my age in this, you know, sort of stage in life can just do that. So I was involved in the theater and I did. I started writing plays and a couple of them did get produced at that university. And then my friend of mine started a small theater company in Minneapolis and we produced a handful of my plays over the years. But it's a tough playwriting, maybe more specifically is a tough road because you have the actors and directors and designers and, you know, costumes and lights and weeks of rehearsal and then six people show up to opening night. So even then, it was still a hobby. I really don't even think then it was, you know, seemed like a career. So I would have to say pretty darn recently when I started screenwriting and then this book in the last few years was when I thought of it as kind of more tangible.
Serafina, were you a bookish kid? Did you read a lot as a kid?
No.
That's okay.
I was brought up in a really small, very religious church school where we didn't actually have traditional learning. We had the PACE system. So you sat at your desk all day by yourself and you self-taught. And I think because there was so much isolation and self-learning and reading, you know, the texts that I didn't really want to do that after I got out of there, you know. So I was kind of an outdoors kid. I didn't really read much till college, I don't think.
Well, I have known a lot of people that were playwrights or screenwriters or actors or directors, and there's something that's a kind of a different energy when you start writing prose than any of those other pursuits. And we definitely understand the draw of those other pursuits, the working together, the collaborative nature of creating something with other people. But there's something really empowering about writing prose by yourself, where you're kind of all of those things. You are the director. You get to control the actors. You get to tell the story. What was your experience in, or what were some of the differences for you in writing this novel versus your other pursuits with stage and screen?
I love the control. It is so different. Not that the others weren't great experiences, but I think I sowed all my wild oats in my 20s, and now I've just carved out this very quiet, peaceful life for myself. it's me and the dog during the day. I work from home, and I, you know, I'm someone who needs a lot of alone time. And so this, it doesn't feel isolating to me. I love being able to, you know, to have the control over the whole story and not hand it off to someone's interpretation. I mean, playwriting is wonderful sort of classic training because you can't really have tons of scene changes and things blowing up, and you need to learn how to craft dialogue that's going to keep an audience interested for those 2 hours in mainly one location. So I'm glad that was my background. And then I started screenwriting maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I optioned 6 or 7 of my screenplays to some different producers that sell to Hallmark and Lifetime, and it wasn't fun. It was really, it's kind of a cliche about all the big talk and promises. You're going to be a star kid type stuff. And that, you know, I did get a lot of that. I got very close. It's interesting. You don't know how it all works maybe until you get into having to set up a movie. Once you have the script, you don't just sell it to, you know, a company. Often you have to attach an actor, attach a director, and try to, what they say, set it up before it'll get funded. And it was just years of stress and getting so close and then it not happening and nothing actually getting made. I guess there's kind of a Hollywood joke also that movies never get made. Writers just live off of options. And I find that to be very true. So I just kind of got tired of it and decided I listened to my first thriller book last year. And as soon as I was finished with it, I decided that's what I needed to do. And so I wrote it right then, like I started the next week.
That is amazing. And I want to get all into that story in just a minute. But you touched on something a minute ago that a couple of things, but when you're writing for stage and you're putting on a play on the stage, you're very limited by the things that you can actually put together and the places you can take the audience, so to speak. The things that you can recreate on the stage, you're limited by those things. And with a novel, you're not limited by any of those things, are you?
No, I mean, it's so different. I almost feel like, though, writing a novel is so much, none of it's easy. Of course, writing is one of the hardest things, you know, but I guess in comparison, it seemed so much easier to me because your imagination can go all over the place. And like you said, you know, you can take the reader anywhere you want and you're not limited by so many factors like you are on stage. Two completely different experiences and each one terrific in its own right, but it was nice to finally have that freedom.
Right. The other thing you mentioned was about the options, and I know a lot of novelists that when they sell that first option, there's all this excitement. This book is going to be a movie or a miniseries, and it doesn't happen a lot of times. But it sure is fun to think and to imagine and to talk about, but Hollywood is a very fickle thing, isn't it?
You know, and you think about, especially now, because everything is direct to your home screen mostly. I mean, deals on Netflix, I think, you don't see a lot of movies, I feel like, on the big screen anymore, unless they're big action, you know, horror type things, because, those kinds you want to go to the theater for, but to get a big blockbustery type budget like that, just seems like it doesn't even happen anymore. People want series, and series are so good now that, I think if you're going to be a screenwriter, write a pilot, you know, it's where things are moving, I think.
Well, you know, when, speaking of that, when you think about, something being optioned, when I see that it's going to be a series, I get really excited. When I see that it's going to be a movie, I'm almost a little let down feeling, because we know that that's going to be kind of max a 2-hour experience. Whereas if it's going to be a Netflix series, you know, I might get, you know, to spend several years in that world, you know, off and on. I think we really are, our tastes are changing in that sense.
We want to binge, and we want, if you really like something, you want a lot of it. So yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, for sure. You said that you read your first thriller a couple of years ago, or about a year ago. What was that book that kind of did that for you and gave you that feeling that you could be transported and that you could then, you know, take other people on a trip like that?
It was Ruth Ware, who I'm obsessed with. I've read everything she's written. I think the first one was In a Dark, Dark Wood. And it had a literary feel. I mean, I love thrillers, but I've never liked gore or horror or slasher or anything like that. I just like that kind of murder mystery type. It's still sure. A little safe. And it had a literary feel to the book. And I mean, I've only really ever read literary fiction. That's all I was really into. I didn't have room in my library for romance or thriller or anything. It was just literary fiction. James Baldwin, Michael Cunningham, Elizabeth Strout, that sort of stuff. So I was going to be directing the fall play. I guess this was October 2018 at the university where I teach now. It's a little bit of a commute. So I thought, I'll try an audiobook. And I started it. And as soon as I finished it, I actually said out loud, that is what I'm doing next. And I started in October and I finished it 10 weeks later. And I remember being mad because it was around Christmas, New Year's, and I was so ridiculous. I was just going to send out a first draft, but I did. I waited till right after the new year. So 2019. And I got an agent like a week later. And then very shortly after that, she got me the multi-book deal with HarperCollins. So it happened really fast. Not like overnight success, because obviously, you know, I've been writing plays for 6-person audiences for a long time to work up to, but it's still kind of, I mean, even though once you make the book deal, I've been waiting over a year for it to actually come out. So now I'm getting used to the idea, but it's still a little bit surreal.
Want to grow as a writer and take your writing to the next level? Give Pro Writing Aid a try. Pro Writing Aid is a grammar checker, style editor, and writing mentor in one package. Pro Writing Aid will never replace a human editor. Rather, it helps you self-edit to a deeper level so that when you send it off to an editor, they will be able to focus on the meat of your writing and not spend their time fixing basic writing issues. Pro Writing Aid is the only platform that offers world-class grammar and style checking, combined with more in-depth reports to help you strengthen your writing. Our unique combination of suggestions, articles, videos, and quizzes makes writing fun and interactive. Writing can be grammatically perfect, but still feel awkward and clumsy. Pro Writing Aid searches out elements like repetitiveness, vague wording, sentence length variation, over-dependence on adverbs, passive voice, over-complicated sentence structures, and so much more. Nothing makes a writer lose credibility faster than spelling and grammar mistakes. Submit clean, error-free writing. Go to ProWritingAid.com and use code HANK20 for 20% off of Pro Writing Aid Premium. Pro Writing Aid. Check it out today.
Yeah. Back to that that kind of argument that we've all heard or been involved in about the difference between literary fiction and commercial fiction. And you said that you're traditionally a literary fiction reader. What is it that about that book or that experience that kind of flipped the switch for you? And how do you feel about the divide between literary and commercial fiction?
You know, the less that happens, the better. I always kind of thought I just loved the atmospheric, character-driven parts of literary fiction. I remember, you know, Giovanni's Room, James Baldwin was just always one of my favorite books. And I was The Hours by Michael Cunningham. I just loved the complex characters and really getting into their psyche. There's not a ton of plot happening, but that was just, you know, something I was really connected and drawn to. But I loved watching thriller movies. So to read one at first, I guess the difference for me was that I was at the edge of my seat and I liked the idea that sometimes struggle as a writer to think about writing the great American novel, but you know, who wants to read it these days? You know, you need, which is unfortunate, but you need something, you know, that at the end of every chapter, there's a reason to turn the page. And I don't know that, I mean, of course, some literary fiction does that, but I think that I was just really drawn to the fast paced kind of urgency of these sorts of books and that they'd be fun to write because, you know, once you put a mystery to solve and a lot of kind of red herrings and stressful situations, it sort of naturally becomes a page turner. And I just like the idea of trying to write something just a little bit more, I don't know, fast-paced, a little scary. I was just kind of like, yeah, this sounds so much fun. Instead of, you know, really sort of intellectual, mind-draining. Sometimes I'm staring at the wall for a week trying to write in the more literary category, but this just seemed like a lot of fun. All still a challenge, but something totally different than anything I've done.
Did you look at it as sort of a challenge that, you know, this is not something that you were as well versed in, or maybe the tools felt a little rusty in your hands, or, you know, did you kind of look at it as, you know, this is going to be a challenge. I'm going to push myself to do something that I'm not quite, you know, as familiar with.
You know, honestly, no, I thought the opposite. I thought this has to be way easier than trying to write, you know, plays or literary fiction, or because I was writing Hallmark Christmas movies, believe it or not. So I have like 6 or 7 rom-com, which was just really not quite me. And they did well enough to get optioned, and it was a great experience. But, you know, I wanted to be a serious writer, but I knew literary fiction really maybe wasn't happening for me. And so I thought, this is going to take all the kind of classic training, like I say, playwriting background, but it's going to be an easier genre. And I think in a way, I mean, to me, thriller is easier than writing comedy. Comedy's hard, or plays. It just seemed, maybe it's because I, you know, I decided it was going to be really a fun departure. I don't know that I thought it as challenging myself or not. I just knew that it was going to be a fun departure, and I was really going to try to make it twisty. And I fell in love with the characters, you know, right away. And so I think that's just kind of what inspired it and what kept me going writing it.
You mentioned your day job a minute ago. What is your day job? Did I see that you teach writing at a university?
Yeah, assistant professor of practice at UT Arlington, University of Texas Arlington. So I've been there about going on 7 years, I guess, this fall. Wow.
Nice. How do you feel that teaching has helped to hone your writing skills?
You know, I teach in the theater department, and so I do teach playwriting, but also acting. And I think teaching acting has helped me as a writer immensely, because, you know, it's all about your super objective. The Stanislavski training is about what does your character really want and what's in their way. And so you're constantly sort of practicing that on stage as a director. I, you know, direct some shows as well. And I was watching this, you know, the master classes that they have, Aaron yeah. Sorkin teaches one. And he was saying almost exactly what I've been, you know, what you learn from Stanislavski and these acting methods, what he calls intention and obstacle. Your character can never have a strong enough or a too strong of an intention or a desire, super objective, I guess. And they can never have too many obstacles. And he gives all these great examples of, you know, throwing roadblocks in your character's way. And so I was like, oh, wow. I mean, this is so similar to, you know, acting training and playwriting. And I loved that idea because it's kind of, you know, falls in line with what I've been teaching. And so you're always kind of on your toes. I was teaching a creative writing class at UTD last semester. And just to go back to the basics of character development and of, you know, plot structure, you don't really think about it anymore. You just kind of do it. But to have to go back and teach somebody else things they've never heard, these basics, keeps you really sort of just on your toes, where maybe you'd sort of forget all that stuff and get too comfortable writing the same kind of stuff.
So last year you have this epiphany, if we can call it that. You read a book and said, I'm going to do that. This seems like something that I would like to try. Was that first try, was that someone's listening? Did that become the book that's out now?
Yes.
That's amazing. There are so many people that, you know, have practice novels and, you know, desk drawer novels that we call them, that you go through the process learning. But to have the first thing that you had written in that form and now it's, you know, published with HarperCollins and out now. What was the first kernel of an idea that this story grew out of?
Well, I do have one other book that was published by a small press about 5 or 6 years ago. And it was just kind of, it didn't know what category it wanted to be. It was partially coming of age, kind of literary fiction, a little LGBT. And so, you know, I did talk to a few bigger publishers and nobody really knew what category it fit in. And a small press published it. And then, you know, like many, it's never heard from again, because unless you have a degree in digital marketing and you self-pub, basically, I mean, it's right. You have to know how to market it. So it just sat there and I just waited for it to go out of print. It was just one of those, I guess. So that was my practice novel. Nothing like, I mean, I'm considering this a debut and so are the publishers. So nothing like nothing like thrillers. But I guess the kernel of the idea, it revolves around a radio talk show host. And I usually start with atmosphere. You know, I knew I wanted it to be Chicago and cold and winter and the sun goes down at 4 p.m. and sort of this kind of depressing atmosphere. I don't know why. I just think starting with that world you kind of want to live in and explore. But I remember, I don't even know if they have these anymore, but maybe in like the late 90s, they'd have these advice talk shows. And I remember one woman in particular taking a road trip and late at night and listening to the advice she was giving. And it was so harsh. I mean, it was your son has a girlfriend and he may be having premarital sex. She's like, kick him out of the house. And you think your husband is cheating. He is. Get a divorce. I mean, really, really very self-righteous, harsh advice to these people. And I always wondered like how
no
that
room for nuance at all.
No. And so like what happens to these lives after? And they love her. You know, they worship this talk show host from what it sounded like. Just, you know, so glad that she was giving them this advice. And I just think about the after effect of what happens with their lives after she so recklessly hands out this advice. And that was kind of an interesting enough question in my head to create the main character around. So I think that's kind of where I started and populated the world of the story from there.
So is that a common thing for you that that stories sort of begin with setting is that normal for you that setting comes first and then characters sort of walk onto the set and then a story, you know, comes out of that? Or is that the normal creative process for you?
I would say with these books, I'm trying to remember, probably more with writing prose. Yeah. So I'm writing about halfway through my third book now. And I think I did start all of them. You know, the second one is just like the heat of the summer in Louisiana. And there's an illicit romance going on. And, you know, just the Spanish moss dripping trees. I do think about that, wanting to be in that world for however long the book takes to write. And then I think plot comes second. And then the characters, who are characters that are going to populate this, probably come third.
So for this book, someone's listening, Faith Finley is a character that we meet. How long into the process did she emerge, and how did you decide what to do to her?
pretty quickly. I mean, when I think about atmosphere, I mean, I think that comes like right away. And then I stare at the wall for maybe like a week or two and walk around the house like a zombie trying to get the plot points. You know, I need to know how it ends. What's that twist going to be? What's that thing at the end? And then the face, kind of the main character, starts to sort of reveal themselves, I guess. I mean, I guess that's the best way I can explain it. But I'm a huge outliner. My students will roll their eyes at how much I beat outlining into the ground. And that's how I explore it. I mean, I literally write the numbers 1 through 30 down a Word doc. And I say, okay, it's going to be about 30 chapters, about 10 pages a chapter. Let's start filling in what I know is going to happen and how it's going to end, which I always need to start with. Otherwise, I don't know what I'm writing to. And then I'll make sure each chapter, I know the main thing that needs to happen. Not so stringent where when I sit down to write, you know, I have this, you know, 50 page outline, but enough bullet points where in this chapter, it's important that these things are revealed, because it's going to, you know, in chapter 7, you're going to need to have known this. And so I think what happens to the characters, the rocks that I throw at the characters, I like to say, just happened through that process, kind of figuring out all the twists and turns and red herrings and just, I don't know, tragedies she's going to go through, and then how she's going to come ahead, how she's going to be proactive in figuring out what's going on. It just really, for me, kind of starts happening through that outlining process.
Some people will, that are heavy outliners like you are, seem to do a lot of the heavy lifting early in the writing process and working through the story problems or, you know, the twists and turns and kind of construct a roadmap, and then the writing goes fairly quickly after that. Some people tend to do that on the back end and they just discovery write all the way through, and then at the end they're like, okay, now what do I, you know, how do I take this jumbled mess and, you know, and pull a narrative through it. How long do you take on the front end in that outlining process before the actual writing starts?
I cannot even imagine that second wave. I admire people who can, I really do admire that. I mean, I'm very organized, so I feel like maybe that I can't guess at, I just feel like there's going to be so much revision. I'm going to give myself more work if I don't know exactly where the story is going and when to introduce people and when to make you wonder about them. And it's fascinating to me that what they call pantsers, I guess, people who just fly by the seat of their pants while they write can. I usually take a few weeks to outline. I do feel like that's the heavy lifting, even though it's a shorter period of time, of course, than the 10 to 12 weeks it usually takes me to write the book. It's intense and it's hard. It's so much harder than writing the book to sit there in agony and just kind of, oh, you know, I feel like I'm constantly just zoned out and always thinking about how I'm going to put the pieces together. And then I think you start to doubt yourself and wonder if you even know how to write a book and if this even makes any sense. You know, it's a kind of a painful few weeks of, and then you have these aha moments where, you know, you're doing something unrelated, cleaning the house, and something hits you, you know, and it pulls everything together and it's so exciting. But once that part's done, man, the rest of it seems just so much easier because you just have all the pieces are already there. The whole roadmap's there. You just got to follow it.
Probably the most famous pantser of all is Stephen King. In his book On Writing, he described people that outlined ahead of time, or outlining for him, let's just put it that way, that he loses, he becomes bored very quickly if he outlines, because to him, he's already created the story, and why does he need to create it again? Do you ever have any of those types of feelings when you're writing, like, well, this story is boring to me because I've already been here, I already know what's going to happen? Do you wrestle with that at all?
No, I think that I don't outline it to death. You know, I outline it where each of those chapters, you know, there's maybe five or six things. I want to, you know, say, oh, she's going to find the gun in this chapter. And if you think of it as 10-ish pages, you know, it's not a huge amount to work with. It makes writing it more digestible in little bits. I just five or six things that are going to happen, but that doesn't mean that I've explored the language and, you know, sort of the sensory details and imagery and what's going on in her mind and how she feels about it. And, you know, I just kind of know a chase is going to happen here, or, you know, they find the body here, you know what I mean? So it's like, I know what's, and I think any Stephen King or any writer before they sit down and do the pantsing approach, they know what the story is in their head. For me, I just am very forgetful, and I think I need, you know, at least the bones of it in place. And then when I sit down on Monday and I'm going to start on chapter 8, you know, I just know, oh, I'm going to accomplish these four things in this chapter, and it gives me a place to start. So I don't find it boring or limiting. I find it actually really freeing because I have somewhere to go and I don't have to labor over and stress anymore. I can just write it because I already know.
World Anvil is a browser-based world-building platform designed for all world builders, writers and novelists, dungeon masters, game developers, and everyone else. World Anvil keeps your world setting safe and organized helps you find your characters, locations, plots, timelines, and maps quickly and easily as you write. Then, if you choose, you can showcase your amazing world building to the world, beautifully and interactively, to keep your readers engaged. You can even use our professional tier to build your career, selling access to behind-the-scenes content your readers will love and growing your community. Build your world setting in any genre with over 25 custom-built world-building templates, complete with prompts to inspire your creativity. Allow your readers to explore the public parts of your world in an innovative new way with interactive maps, timelines, and wiki-style articles. Give special access to co-authors, beta readers, customers, or patrons to see exclusive behind-the-scenes content. There's a free version to get started with all of the major features. Guild membership offers you a host of extra options, including comprehensive privacy settings, co-authors, presentation options, and so much more. Join our community of over 250,000 world builders, including professional authors. Take part in competitions and learn more about world building at this fantastic online community. Use the coupon code HANK to get 20% off all 6 and 12 month subscriptions. WorldAnvil.com. I'm a recent convert and I know you will be too. Noveler is the best way to write a novel. Why? Quite simply because we've made it the easiest place to do it. Writing a novel is hard enough. Noveler takes care of all the logistical bits of writing a novel, just leaving that small matter of the words to you. It's a clean, beautiful writing interface with writing analytics, goals and streaks, advanced grammar checking, version control, day, evening, and night modes, and many other features designed to take all the stress out of writing. Tell us what you need and we'll build it. Together, we'll build a better tool. With a design-led approach, all the right tools that you need, Noveler saves all your words constantly, allows you to manage and order your novel easily. It's accessible from any device, desktop or mobile. It syncs to Google Drive and Dropbox. It allows exports in various formats, including ebook and more. It also has nice touches like allowing you to write both offline and online, unique for a web-based platform. Everyone needs help with their writing from inspiration through to grammar checking, so we're doing our best to provide that support. We integrate that support directly into Noveler. Our advanced grammar checker powered by Pro Writing Aid does everything from spell check to style advice. Our writing courses include the incredible Tim Clare's Couch to ADK. We're really excited to offer all Author Stories listeners 30% off Noveler for a whole year, and it doesn't matter if you choose to sign up for the monthly or annual plan, you'll get 30% off. All you need to do is use the discount code HANK when you sign up. Noveler, N-O-V-L-R. That's noveler.org.
I've heard writers say that if they get a great idea, that they won't even write it down, because if it's a truly great idea, there's no way you'll forget it. And I'm like, oh no, I have to write it down. I'm way too forgetful. It could be a brilliant idea and I'll still forget it. I agree with you there. That's just silliness to get bored with something that's in the middle of the creative process. So Faith Finley is a radio host, like we talked about earlier, that you kind of had this idea based on these things that used to be fairly commonplace. What happens to Faith? What's the story that starts unraveling in the book?
So at the beginning, she wakes up. There's been a car accident, and she is concerned that her husband's hurt. She's asking for him, at the scene of the accident, and they don't know what she's talking about. Your husband wasn't in the car. There's no other person here. And they start to really think that she's a little bit out of her mind. And so you come to find out that her husband is missing. And so I do a past present approach. She's trying to figure out what happened to him. Doing her own sort of detective work as she's, I think everybody sort of wonders if she was involved in something. And then she starts to think that he planned to leave her, still doesn't understand how he could disappear in the scene of an accident. You start to really kind of wonder about her. She definitely has some substance abuse issues. She's a psychologist who has an abusive past and is working with, you know, women of domestic abuse and stuff like that to kind of, I guess, pay it forward after she's met some success. So she's a reliable person in that sense, but she's also very flawed and deals with, you know, going to booze when her life's falling apart. And then she's also involved in a scandal from one of her former clients who is kind of pointing a finger at her for some inappropriate behavior. So her whole world's falling apart. The rest of the book is, you know, sort of after you kind of find all this out, it's just her figuring out why she's being accused, what happened to her husband, and things just get worse and worse and worse for her until she starts getting little notes ripped out of her own book, advice for victims of domestic abuse, basically threats that she should be scared and she might be next. And so kind of all goes downhill from there until the end, where hopefully you think you've suspected everybody and you were wrong, hopefully, if I've done my job.
You, a very popular tool nowadays in thriller writing is the unreliable narrator, and the person that you become so involved with, but you ultimately can't trust them, and you know, it keeps the reader confused the whole time because you don't know who to believe, and not that you do that with Faith, but there is something about a very flawed protagonist that you know that she doesn't make the best decisions, and you can see her going into these train wreck situations, and you're wanting her to not do it, but you on the other hand very much understand what motivates her. Could you talk a little bit about writing a character like that that's very flawed, and we can see her flaws just, you know, right on her shirt sleeve, yet we care about her, you know, we grow to definitely want her to come out of this okay. What is it about when you're creating a character that makes them likable when they on the surface don't seem like a very likable character?
It's funny you should use that word, because I would call her unreliable and I would call her flawed for sure. But yeah, what's so interesting to me is, you know, and it's out of all the reviews, and the reviews have, you know, have been kind for the most part, you know, they've been really good. But even the people who review it kindly, I hear the word over and over and over and over. This morning, I just looked at 3 or 4 more reviews, all good. All of them called her unlikable. And I am kind of surprised by that. And I shouldn't be. Maybe I take it personally because, you know, there's a lot of you in your protagonist probably.
Sure.
I feel like I thought that she, you know, she has this incredible relationship with her husband, the love of her life. And I feel like if my husband were missing or dead, or the things she does would be minor compared to how much, you know, like if you think of a real life situation, I can't imagine why she would be likable going through that kind of trauma. She's mixed up in a scandal. She has no idea, you know, her whole life's falling apart. She doesn't need to say all the right things or do all the right things. I don't think that would ring true. And so sometimes I have a little eye roll because I feel like people say that a lot about female characters more. I think about books like The Last Mrs. Parrish, which is delightful. Yeah. And the main character from the first page is out to ruin this family's life and steal the husband.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
She's not likable. The girl on the train was a wonderful book, and she was, I don't know if she drank more than Faith, but it was probably pretty close. I don't think they have a responsibility to be likable. I think they're going through a lot. We put them through a lot on purpose. And that if they were super likable, it would be, you know, more Disney Hallmark maybe. And right. So it's an interesting comment to keep hearing. It doesn't bother me because, like I said, I don't think that she necessarily needs to be, but I also thought she'd be a little more sympathetic based on, you know, losing the love of her life, like, wouldn't you lose your mind and, you know, whatever your vice is, drink too much, do whatever, be, absolutely, you know, terrible to everyone. So it's been really interesting to keep getting that feedback. But I didn't worry about that when I was writing her. I was just thinking about making her raw and the bad decisions she makes are, you know, merited, I think. And even if you're screaming at her not to do something, she just feels like she'll do anything to you know, find him.
Well, I love it because, you know, on the surface, all of us want to be seen as likable, dependable people, and that other people look at as, you know, a pleasure to be around and all of that stuff. And in reality, when we're home alone or with our family and the closest people to us, that, you know, we all have some dark things about us that we don't wish were true, but they just are. And, you know, humans are humans. We're flawed. All of us are. And, you know, if you write people with the facade that we all use in public, it's just an extension of the game that we all play. When you really get past that and get to the realities of how people are, that's when dynamic things can happen.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, I just think approaching it from a really raw, honest place was, you know, my only option. I didn't want to gloss her over or, you know, like I said, just have her say all the right things in these moments. I wanted her. And if, you know, I think if she has you know, some people have said, well, they cringe at the idea that she's a psychologist giving advice and yet she's, you know, going to the bottle every time, you know, things are crumbling in her life. But I think, you know, it does, your profession doesn't, you know, exclude you from having a substance abuse issue or, you know, totally breaking down and, you know, losing it. I don't think that, you know, so creating her just raw and human and desperate was the goal. And so if that makes her a little bit unlikable, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And the messenger doesn't have to be a perfect vessel for the message to be true. It just, and that's the great thing about having a psychologist that goes to the bottle. You know, that it doesn't necessarily negate the advice she gives. It's just that she is also struggling with these things, which I think makes her a great protagonist.
Exactly. It doesn't mean she's, you know, she's not practicing at the time this is going on. She's kind of taken a break and she's sort of been forced to because of the scandal, but, you know, she doesn't really have anything left. And so it's not like she's, you know, drinking on the train in the morning before she goes and sees her clients. I mean, she's just like at home alone, you right. know, falling apart. But yeah, I agree too. I mean, the complexity of that is, you know, she's professional and together and, you know, reliable in her life in many ways. And then on the flip side, you know, that dark side that you're talking about that everybody has, you know, she's definitely complex.
Right. Well, the book is called Someone's Listening. There are links to it in the show notes of this episode where you can grab it in hardback or Kindle edition or audiobook. Serafina, you said that this was your first book and that you are in the process of writing the third book. You've been very busy these last few months, haven't you?
Well, it was a two-book, kind of a three-book deal. So they bought the first two outright, so I had to write the second one pretty quickly. My agent just said, they might ask what else you have. So if you want to whip up like a synopsis for a second book idea, that might be helpful. And to my surprise, they did buy the second one. And then they have an option for first rights of refusal for the third. I guess that kind of depends on how the first one goes. So I'm working on that now in hopes that that'll kind of follow the second release, which comes out next summer.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to see what the second release is. We're going to send everyone to pick up their copy of Someone's Listening. Serafina, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you're doing, is there a place where they can find you online and connect with you?
Yeah, I'm new to Twitter. I can't say I'm very active. I have a author Facebook page. It's Serafina Novaglass Author, and website serafinanovaglass.com.
Excellent. We're going to put links to those in the show notes of this episode where everyone can find you. Serafina, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writer's community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community.